So the chairman of this session is a very known tough guy, so I will not dare to take a single second more. Next year, March, the Nestor collaboration deployed a test detector equipped with 12 photomultipliers and with the final version of the Nestor telescope electronics. The deployment was very successful, and today I want to report on the performance of the detector, and I want to present a measurement of the atmospheric muon flux at the detector depth. These two papers, they are going to publish very soon, and after the end of the conference, preprints will be available. This is the Nestor collaboration, and this is the Nestor site. You want to see it? And this is the Nestor site. It's located close to the so-called Hellenic Trench, very close to the deepest part of the Mediterranean. Is a plateau of 8 times 9 square kilometers with excellent water quality, 4,000 meters mean depth, with very mild currents, non-sedimentology problems, and non-bioluminescence problems, as you will see later. The Nestor detector, the basic unit of the Nestor detector is this hexagonal titanium floor. It carries a pair of optical modules in its tip. This is a 15-inch Hamamatsu tube. And the electronics are located at the center inside the large titanium sphere of 1 meter diameter. By stacking 12 of those, one on top of each other, with a distance, let's say, 30 meters, you have a tower. This is really the telescope unit. The tower is connected to the shore via an electro-optical cable. And a tower, it has an effective area for neutrinos of energy greater than 10 TeV of the order of 20 square meters. And for condensed tracks, it has a low threshold as low as 4 GeV. The unique feature of the Nestor detector, because God gave to this excellent water qualities to this site, is that we can have photomultipliers looking upwards as well. That means that we can see very high energy neutrinos, otherwise they cannot come to us because the Earth is not transparent. At our site, neutrinos coming upwards. Every floor of the Nestor detector is working as an independent detector. Each floor has 12 photomultipliers. Inside the titanium sphere of the electronics, there is a local trigger, and this sub-detector sends the data to the shore. It's been received by a special board called SOR board, and a central computer builds online an event. In order to build an event, we have a global clock broadcasted to each floor, tagging the giving a timestamp to each trigger, and then we can very easily, with a simple algorithm, we can build a global event. Few things about the electronics. Inside the titanium sphere, the electronics are concentrated in two main boards. The SOR board, that really is slow control stuff, and the floor board, which is responsible for PMT pulse sensing, majority logic, event triggering, digitization, packaging data, send them to the shore. The heart of this module, these ASIC ATWDs, designed and built by our colleagues in Berkeley. Here you see the digitized waveform of a photomultiplier. I have to say that each channel of the ATWDs has 128 Wilkies and ADCs on the COMO ramp, and what you will see here is the 128 digitizations. I will skip the DAQ architecture. And then I have to say that before we deploy the detector, it has to go through very, very detailed tests. We have a paper published in YIM with all the tests and the functionality of the optical modules. I have just here to say that every single photomultiplier has been calibrated, and we know with high accuracy what is the pulse height distribution at the one photoelectron level. And also, every single transmission line of the photomultiplier has been calibrated, and we have defined the response function. So, about the deployment, I don't have to say many things. Larry Sulak gave a much better talk than me on the deployment. I saw you here one of the Nestor star folded. Each arm of the star has two modules by 5 meters. Because we had very bad weather conditions and we want to carry the star on the cable ship, we use just two of the four, one module in each arm. So we deploy a detector of 12 meter diameter. Here is the bottom unit, the anchor, carrying environmental sensors and the junction box. This has been deployed to 3.9 kilometers, and 80 meters above was the star. So we were monitoring all the environmental, electrical, and operational parameters of the detector. Some historical plots. This is our online monitor presenting in real time the depth of the detector as was deployed as a function of time. You will see that when it reaches something more than 3.8 kilometers, it stopped and it stays there. Here we have the inclinometers. Here we have the a compass, saying the rotation. So you see that we had a few degrees rotation in the beginning of the deployment. I don't have the time to talk about the data analysis flow. Just have to tell you that later on you will see comparisons with Monte Carlos. We have a very, very detailed simulation of the detector, of the electronics as well, the physics. When I will say later on Monte Carlo prediction, I mean what is the response, the simulated response of the detector to atmospheric muons a la Okada model with this, plus, of course, what is the contribution of the accidental coincidence background because of the potassium 40. Here you will see our standard calibration count, that is the potassium 40 decays producing Cherenkov light at the 1.3 photoelectron level. You will see a typical pulse height distribution and photomultiplier. You will see the two components, one photoelectron, two photoelectrons. These components has been measured and defined in the laboratory before the deployment. Here you will see a demonstration of the unbiasedness, the trigger is not unbiased. You will see the instantaneous PMT rates for the 12 PMTs as a function of the coincidence level. I have to say that when we are selecting events, we are forming fast coincidences between the PMTs, and this is the level of the coincidence. You will see that the instantaneous PMT rate is independent of the selection criteria. But as you saw in the talk before, sometimes the photomultipliers are getting crazy. You have an increase of the rate. Here you see the 12 photomultipliers, but you see only the ones looking downwards. They have this behavior. That means that this biological, these bacteria or whatever producing the light are located in space. We had studied the pulse height distribution of the photomultipliers during these events. And we saw that it's very, very similar to the potassium 40 pulse height distribution. This is the total charge accumulated in a trigger. That means that the bioluminescence is producing light on the level of one photoelectron. Also, we measure that our site is bioluminescence free. Our dead time is only 1.1% of the total experimental time. This is the gift to this site. We use our calibration system. The calibration system are LED flashes above and below the hexagonal floor. We cross-check the timing between the photomultipliers by taking the time difference. And also, we cross-check the slewing and the time resolution of our photomultiplier. Here is the first comparison with the Monte Carlo. Here the trigger rates as a function of the coincidence level, data in Monte Carlo. You will see that is a perfect agreement. We understand very well our detector. And the dashed line here is the contribution of atmospheric muons. You will see that making six-fold coincidences, you reject the potassium-40 contribution. The same agreement you will see in a different threshold when you run the photomultipliers, a different threshold. The same agreement you will see between data and Monte Carlo on the total charge accumulated within the trigger window. You will see in 30 millivolts and 120 millivolts. But also, if you see in every individual photomultiplier, the pulse height distribution, when it participates in six-fold, seven-fold, and so on coincidences, it agrees very, very well with our simulated behavior of the photomultiplier based on our laboratory measurements. So this is an indication that we understand what we are doing. I will skip that, but no, I will say a few things. This is the pulse arrival time weighted by the charge. So, in other words, this is the correlation between the accumulated photoelectrons and the arrival times, data in Monte Carlo for different conditions. They agree very much. Now coming to the track reconstruction. Here is the input to an interactive fitter we have. Here you will see there are two pair of plots corresponding to an arm, up-looking, down-looking photomultiplier, and you will see the digitized pulse. So the geometrical problem is to define a track which emitting photons in a cone of 42 degrees it can give us the relative times as been digitized in our detector. So this is what we have to do is we have to express the expected time as a function of the track parameters, form a chi-square, and minimize it. Several times in this minimization, you are getting in double minima. And you cannot separate them using the chi-square of the fit. This is the chi-square of the fit for 2 degrees of freedom. Both the candidates, they have a very good chi-square. This is a known ambiguity because of the symmetry of a symmetry in the Cherenkov emission known as a mirror track. You see that these two candidates, they have a 3D angle of 2 times the Cherenkov angle. The only way to get rid of these ambiguities is to use the charge of other photomultipliers, in other words, to use the distribution of the lights on the PMTs. I don't have the time to go through. But I'm telling you that we build a likelihood, and by a likelihood hypothesis, we can separate between these two cases. So here is an example in this event. This is the one with a less probability. This is the most favored one. This is a very nice candidate for a neutrino interaction, but we don't say so. I don't have the time to go on details here. But I will just demonstrate. Here is the chi-square probability distribution for data in Monte Carlo. You see the agreement. Here is the negative logarithm of this photon likelihood. You see the agreement between data and Monte Carlo. Also, we apply some quality cuts. You know, we have a very small detector. The lever arm is small. So this detector cannot give you accurate tracks, except if you go in some special cases in the phase space when the detector can help you. So we are cutting on the total number of accumulated photoelectrons per track and on the impact parameter. But you see that data in Monte Carlo, they agree very much. Our Monte Carlo studies, they tell us that we have a peak 8.5 degrees resolution. But when we are relaxing our criteria, you will see here tracks that they have 84 degrees pseudo tracks, okay? That are the mirror solutions. Here is the distribution of the estimated errors between data and Monte Carlo. The estimated errors from the feed. You will see the agreement. Here is the pool distribution from the Monte Carlo that is a nice Gaussian with sigma 1 at the mean at 0 that proves you that indeed we reconstruct the tracks consistently and also we have a consistent error estimation. Now I have to rush very, very fast. Here is our raw data, the zenith angle distribution, data in Monte Carlo. As I told you, the Monte Carlo is this Okada model. If you form here a chi-square test, the probability is 52%. Very good agreement. Larry saw you yesterday the azimuth angle distribution, as you expected. And now we'll go to a measurement of the cosmic ray flux. Usually we parameterize it with this form. This is the vertical intensity. This is the index alpha that is giving you the shape of the distribution. We are doing a very sophisticated analysis. I do not have the time, except if you ask me, to tell you. This is our solution. Of course, these two variables are functionally correlated. There you see the correlation here. Here is our results. We made a lot of tests to prove that our techniques we are using are indeed unbiased and statistically right techniques. We made more tests. Finally, we calculated the systematic errors because of the selection criteria, the technique, reweighting and binning technique we're using, energy dependence, and the functional parameterization of the muon flux. This is our final measurement. Very good agreement with what Dumas had measured at the same depth, also with what Nestor collaboration had measured a few years ago. And as Larry saw you yesterday, if you take the word data compilation and the phenomenological parameterization of Bugay et al., you will see our measurement here. We are very proud of our measurement because, if you see, in this area is worldwide the most accurate measurement. And finally, my conclusions that our objectives and the concerning the test of the detector and the demonstration of the ability of the proposed neutrino detector telescope to reconstruct tracks were met successfully. What next? In this autumn, we want to finish this phase. This phase will finish when we will have four detectors. So this autumn, we are completely ready to deploy four detectors. Later on, we want 2006 to deploy one whole tower. Of course, here you will see the effective area we're expecting to have with four floors and with a whole tower. Of course, kilometer cube is coming, and we want there to play a very, very important role. So perhaps we will reschedule this item here according to the success of these studies. And thank you very much.
So we now have time for some questions. Such a peaceful audience.
They're afraid of you, I think.
Yes, go ahead. I can't.
In this data exposure, you may have had one or two upcoming events. Can you tell us something about that?
If you naively, if you make some back on the envelope calculations, you expect to have something like 10 upcoming neutrino tracks. We do have 20 candidates. We are not sure that how good candidates are they, but we are working on that. And I hope before we deploy the four flow detectors to have some results, either negative or positive.
Have you done any Monte Carlo studies whether you can distinguish tau and muon charged currents for contained events?
So I didn't understand. Can you repeat, please?
Have you done Monte Carlo studies to find out whether for contained events you can distinguish between muon events and tau events?
Whoa.
Oh, you haven't.
Perhaps somebody else did, right? But as far as I remember, no.
Well, let us thank our speaker again.